Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Back to hour number two of Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette, along with Dr. Samira Umat. So glad that you are here and you were listening. We've got some calls stacking up here, but there's room for you. 206-421-5757. Now, Shirley, you said you had one more question for Dr. Umat. And Shirley, what was that question you had for Dr. Umat? Oh, we don't have Shirley. Okay, call back. Feel free to call back, Shirley, and we'll get that question for you. Kay from Seattle. We will talk to Kay now. Good morning, Kay. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning, Kay.
Good morning. Good morning. My question is, how does a shingle shot work to supposedly protect you from shingles? I'm a little concerned about the side effects. That's why I wanted to know how it actually works to help.
Well, the vaccines, so, you know, if you had chickenpox when you were younger, then you have the virus in your system. And what happens is that during stressful times or when your immune system is compromised, the virus can resurge and cause another active infection for you. Mm. And what the vaccine does is basically it prevents that infection from becoming active again.
How does that work? Does it go into the nervous system or the vaccine?
The vaccine stays in the bloodstream, and it doesn't. I don't know that it goes into the nervous system, Kay. I think it just affects the virus by reducing its expression of disease.
Okay, because one of the possible side effects is Guillain-Barré.
Yes,
it is. Which is French polio.
Yes, it is. Very rare, but it has happened.
Right, and that's why I'm wondering, how does that become a possible reaction if it doesn't go into your spinal cord and your nervous system?
Right. Yeah, no, I'm not so sure, but you are right. The Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a weakness in the nervous system, does happen. And the vaccine can sometimes precipitate that. But if it is caused by the vaccine, usually there is complete recovery over time.
Oh,
but Guillain-Barré, if it is just, you know, caused not from the vaccine, but it just happens, then the recovery process is difficult. But from the vaccine, I've had a patient like that, actually, and he was admitted to a rehab facility, and he did recover, and we were able to send him home.
Because I have polio, I'm a little cautious about
certainly.
The vaccine.
Oh, yeah, but, certainly.
Yeah, but I was just wondering the connection there.
When was your polio diagnosed? Long time ago, when you were young?
47 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. Okay. Do you still have any?
Yeah, but it was from the vaccine. There was a bad batch of vaccine, and so therefore I'm a little leery of vaccines since then.
Well, I don't blame you.
Yes.
And I don't blame you at all. I do think you need to be careful. I would maybe defer to your doctor and see if the risk-benefit ratio is good enough for you or not. And I know that as a general rule, you know, we don't use acyclovir long enough. But if you do have an outbreak, we do recommend that you use the medication for longer than general.
Oh, so there is a medication for if you were to get shingles.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
What's that? If you get shingles, they had used your valcyclovir or acyclovir for a longer duration of time. And then, you know, the vaccine does affect your immune system, and the reaction is basically from a secondary reaction from the immune system. So, yeah, you should be very careful about it. I would definitely talk to your doctor more before you go ahead and get this done.
Now, when you say it affects your immune system, it affects it in a good way or a bad way?
Most people, good way, because it will prevent them from getting a serious infection. But in your case, where you've already been compromised once, I'd be very, very careful.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you bet, Kay. Thank you for the call.
Thank you, Kay.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
I remember when my mom had shingles about 20 years ago,
yeah.
And it was for a very long time, and I remember she had to put sheets up on the windows just so she could walk around without anything on because she was in so much pain.
I thought light was my
yeah. And she always said, get that shot when you are old enough. Get that
shot. So for people who don't have the issues that Kay did and mm-hmm. who are otherwise generally healthy and had chicken pox when mm-hmm. they were younger, and now you're older a few decades later, it is a good idea to get the vaccine because it'll prevent the resurgence of that virus, which, like you just said, in your mom's case, she couldn't.
Wow.
It can be. It follows the dermatome of the nerve it is active in, but it can be extremely painful. It causes lesions in where it, you know, either they're on the face or on the mm-hmm. chest, but it follows a specific nerve pattern. So it is the nerves that are damaged that it is affecting, and the virus will reactivate there. It causes very, very pain. First, it actually starts with maybe just a itch or a rash, and then it develops into the pustules, and you got to jump on this very quickly. And unfortunately, a lot of times the doctors are not giving the acyclovir for long enough. If you treat it for long enough, which is not just a few weeks or a few days, you really have to treat it for a long period of time, then you can suppress this virus in your body.
Okay. Very good. That's the shingles vaccine. That's the one Dr. Mixon will say really hurts and is very sore for a couple of days. So do it in an arm you're not going to use.
That's right. The new vaccine is a
Shingrix.
Shingrix.
Oh, Shingrix. Okay.
And it's two vaccines. You get the first one, and yes, it does cause some pain in the muscle and in the arm, and reduces range of motion. And then you mm-hmm. go back to get the second booster of that dose in about 4 to 6 weeks. Time
okay. And this is a shingles vaccine has been around for a very long time.
Yeah, but this is the newer one,
so even better.
Yeah.
Very good.
But it is two doses as opposed to one.
Okay. Very good. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Samira Umat. We're going to go to Paul's Bow again. Roger is on the line. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Roger.
I have two different hernia questions.
Okay.
The first is I had an attempted colonoscopy. I'm celebrating the 50th anniversary of having a driver's license, and I'm in pretty good health.
Congratulations!
So pretty active. And so they attempted a colonoscopy, determined that I had a double hernia, kind of presenting itself on one side, especially towards the end of the day. And so we had surgery, I think it was in July. The surgeon put in mesh, and she was very happy with the results. And I was I was super good about, you know, the no, I think it was 10 pound limit at first, and then 40 pounds, and then, you know, everything looked good. And so then they, you know, took the limit off, except they said, try not to do anything, you know, super heavy for a year because of the, they did the, orthoscopic, you know, I've got three cute little scars on my belly from, you know, they did it that way. And, recently I've kind of realized that, I'm basically having the same symptoms I had before.
Mm.
Not really in pain, but, you know, definite bulging,
ouch,
towards the end of the day. And then it's totally gone in the morning after, you know, laying down and sleeping. The surgeon said that I would have some, you know, she said, basically you've got a void and, you know, the body wants to fill that oftentimes with fluid. This is, I feel very confident or pretty confident this is not fluid, that this is, part of me, protruding. So I guess my concern is it common for, it not to work the first time and have to have surgery redone? And if, you know, my concern is whether, whether, I should return to this surgeon's, you know, super, super happy with, bedside manner, explaining things, all that. So anyway, I guess that, you know, so that's my question.
Tough one, right? So because I'm not in the surgical field, Roger, I'm afraid I'm not going to be of that much help to tell you how common this side effect is with the mesh. I guess if you followed all protocol, they should have kind of given you some guideline into how common this was or whether it would happen or not. And then the next question, of course, is what next steps should you be taking? Do you need to go back in for them to replace the mesh or to reinforce it with something? And again, I'm afraid not the best person to ask these questions. I do know that the mesh have become better and better over time. They've given better results. They have been doing, like you said, the microscopic surgeries where they're not needing to open up the whole bowel wall, which is good. And then, you know, most people have been doing fine. I sometimes see some patients that have chronic complications because of the mesh, infections, obstructions, and so on and so forth. But that's not what you're experiencing, and I honestly don't know what frequency of patients need to go back and have it redone.
Okay.
Maybe a little Google search, maybe a little, talk to the physician's office or talking to her directly, finding out a little bit more information about what type of mesh was used for you, whether it will give you long-term. Obviously, you're not having benefit right now. You have had a recurrence. And then maybe even getting another consult from somebody else to see and then deciding for yourself whether you need to go back to this person or to find somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't be scared to advocate for yourself and to get a second opinion. It's always a good idea to have somebody else take a look.
Yeah. Okay. So you wouldn't be a good person for a hiatal hernia question either then, probably?
Well, what is your question? Well, how about we take the break?
Yep, yeah, we'll take a break and we'll be back with you, Roger. Stay on the line. And then Charles, we'll talk with you next. Here's that number to get through, just like Roger and Charles. 206-421-5757. This is Leading Edge Medicine. We'll be back.
It's another tequila sunrise, staring slowly across the sky.
Leading Edge Medicine on the very first Saturday in November. Here we are on a
indeed
cold, rainy day.
Where did this year go? It's
yes, where
already
did it go? Oh, maybe you're there with a hot cup of coffee or hot tea. We've got our tea and coffee in the studio and taking your calls. On the phone, we have Roger from Paulsbo. And Roger, you had another question concerning a hiatal hernia.
Yeah. Roger, what's your question about hiatal hernia?
Well, since it's kind of a surgery question, can I change my question?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, so I probably similar to a lot of people at my age, I'm having a little bit of constipation issues and recommendations on how to deal with that. I probably don't drink enough water, so I realize that might be part of the problem.
Yeah. Fiber?
Any other?
Fiber? Fiber? How much fiber? Yeah, fiber. So, you know, constipation is not an uncommon problem as we get older. The bowel becomes sluggish. The gastrocolic reflexes that with every time you eat food, you know, the colon kind of moves and propels the food forward so that you can get rid of the waste products. If you drink more water, naturally, the colon keeps the stool nice and soft and bulkier. Fiber keeps it bulkier. So to prevent constipation, you want to encourage more and more fiber in the diet. And I actually do tell my patients that I don't mean that you eat more salad or that you eat more beans and lentils that have fiber in them, but actually adding fiber, either psyllium husk or flaxseed or even Metamucil. So you want to either put that in your protein drink or put it on your top of your salad or just mix it. Sometimes mixing flaxseed with water is yuck.
But yeah, they get all slimy.
It does. But Benefiber is a product available over the counter that I do like. It is clear when you mix it in water. It's tasteless. It's odorless. And it does help with loosening up the bowel movements a little bit and preventing constipation from getting worse. The other thing that I do like is actually a supplement with magnesium in it. And magnesium is a calming supplement. And as we get older, we generally tend to get muscle aches and pains and spasms. So I do like magnesium and about 200 milligrams. It kind of softens the stool as well. Its side effect is diarrhea. So if you do have tendency for constipation and some muscle aches and pains, then magnesium helps. But my first go-to will be hydrate well and also add fiber, not just in your diet, but add extra fiber, flaxseed, psyllium husk, Metamucil, whatever you can take. I'm not that fond of fiber capsules. People always ask me, well, you know, I take 8 fiber capsules. I don't know. Usually, if you're taking that many, I don't think they're working. But if you're happy with it and it's working for you, fine. But I would add extra. And one that I like is Benefiber or Metamucil.
Okay.
Great. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate the show.
Hey, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Roger.
Sorry couldn't help you with the hernia, you know, not in the surgery field, so don't know much about that. With hiatal hernia, though, I do want to say a little thing. You know, the diaphragm that separates the chest wall from the abdominal cavity has a few areas of weakness in it. One of the areas which causes a hiatal hernia is where the esophagus, which is your food pipe, goes into the stomach. So it goes from the oral cavity into the chest cavity and then into the stomach. And this is an area where it can develop a weakness, which is that the stomach will start to protrude out into the chest wall, and therefore the acids and the juices in the stomach get stuck in the chest cavity, causing symptoms of hiatal hernia, which are reflux. And the most common things they'll do is, you know, weight loss, smoking cessation, change your diet, use proton pump inhibitors for a period of time to see if that helps. And then if that doesn't, then you do need to strengthen the diaphragm, and then they do in surgery where they will basically tack it so that it doesn't, the stomach doesn't slide back up into the chest cavity, which is what causes the problem. So, you know, those are some of the things that I can mention about hiatal hernia. One of the things that we have talked about on our show is that the muscle, smooth muscle, skeletal muscle, the diaphragm muscle actually can be strengthened over time with anabolic hormones. So testosterone can actually help strengthen the diaphragmatic muscle. And therefore, if you are following a you know, conservative or functional medicine protocol, which is stop the alcohol, stop smoking, lose weight, and your symptoms are still getting worse, and you're contemplating surgery, one of the things you could maybe think about is adding a hormone replacement program into your regimen. Okay? I don't know if
that's okay. Okay. Thank you, Roger. We are going to quickly head over to Tacoma. We've got Charles on the line.
Hi, Charles.
Hi. Good morning, Charles.
Hello. first question in reference to the person who was on talking about the constipation.
Yeah.
I found a good remedy for that is, like, I use olive oil throughout the day. I take a 1 tablespoon of olive oil 3 times a day with my meals. And so that keeps things moving along pretty smooth and easy. And so
oh, good.
That's a good remedy for me. Might try
nice.
Sometimes.
And very
you can also
nice.
Use flaxseed oil, avocado oil, any of those real slippery type foods. So okay.
Sure.
All right.
Okay.
Slides. I just want to pass that on.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing your
thank
personal
you for
experience.
Charles.
Yeah. Slides thing
real
right
about a carotid artery, okay?
Mm. Yes.
Wednesday, they're wanting to do a carotid artery test on me. And what they want to do is they want to go in and test and see if I'm getting good blood flow throughout, you know, my arterial system. I had glaucoma, and then all of a sudden it changed into a neovascular glaucoma, okay? And they were saying that my right carotid artery was like about, it was initially about 85 to 90% block. And I went on my food resume and changed some things. It went down to 75. Now they're saying it's back up to about 90, 95. And they want to do this carotid artery procedure, which is called that's kind of hard for me to pronounce. You probably
carotid endarterectomy.
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
wow.
Yes,
okay.
And they're wanting to do that. But before they do that, they want to stick a needle in my arm and shoot some dye in there and see whether or not, you know, everything's going through properly, because one of the tests said that there was no blood flow getting through, that it was completely blocked. And the other test they did say, oh, no, you know, it's not blocked, you know. So I'm trying to determine, you know, should I or shouldn't I, you know, is it or isn't it?
If you have that much blockage, I mean, this is an emergency. In my clinical experience, I've picked this up for some of my patients when I've done some investigations, and just based on symptoms alone, and I have found more than 90% blockage, they were sent directly from radiology to surgery. There wasn't even a question.
Okay. I just want to interrupt you. I hope you don't mind if I interrupt you in between
Not
while you're
all.
Talking.
Go ahead.
Because some of the things they've said already, and I did some research and found out they weren't to be true. Now, they're saying that if it's blocked, there's no problem, you know, that it will just, you know, nothing will happen. You won't have any strokes. They'll just be blocked off and the other arteries will take over. They say, but if there's a little bit going through, they either want to do a TCAR or they want to do that carotid endarterectomy,
yeah.
You see, my tongue's not pretty good with this speech.
Those are difficult, long, difficult words, yeah. When there is some flow, the risk for a blood clot breaking off and blocking a narrower vessel is very high. So the risk for stroke is very high if there is any little flow. And so that's why they want to treat it and prevent that from happening. And if there is no flow at all, I guess what they're saying to you is it'll start collateral circulation on its own, so don't do anything. But if you have any flow there, what I'm hearing you say is you do have some flow. And if you do have that, then I do think you shouldn't, I mean, you should follow what they're saying and go ahead and get the carotid and arterectomy done, because otherwise the risk for stroke, for a little piece of the clot breaking off and blocking a blood vessel, is high.
Mm.
Okay, yeah. And okay. I never had stroke before. And it was like in 2008 when I started taking this eye drop medicine, which causes TIA. I went off of it, and that was in 2008, 2009. And I didn't have another episode like that till 2023, which is this year. And I had a three-minute tingling, three-second tingling in my fingertips. And after they checked me out, and they said, but you don't have any stroke. But then they came up with this idea of this carotid artery thing, you know. And I really, you know, not up on them, you know, cutting in my side of my neck, you know. I don't think nobody cares. And the other one was that on the test to see whether or not blood flow was going through. They didn't tell me how they did it. They said they just used the arm, you know, to go into the blood vessel. So what do they use? Do they use that needle? Do they use the drip? Or how do they do that?
You know what, Charles? We hear the music, so we're going to have to take a break. We'll be back and tell you what they do when they test for your blood flow, okay? You stay on the line, Charles. And Susie, we'll talk with you in just a few minutes. Stay right there. Take it easy. Good morning. Almost noontime. I'm Lynette, here with Dr. Samira Umat on Leading Edge Medicine. Dr. Jerry Mixon will return in the next couple of weeks. He is under the weather today, which we've never seen. Seldom seen.
That's right.
Listening to his doctor, Dr. Umat, who said, stay home. Don't come in.
I did
rest
not say
that voice.
I did tell him to rest.
Yes, rest that voice.
But I still thought that he would show up this morning.
Okay, so Charles, we're going to talk with you for just another couple minutes, and then we're going to head to our other calls.
Right. So let's recap a little bit, Charles, for you with the carotid artery blockage. And then the investigations showing that it is a significant blockage, and then the treatment looking at maybe carotid and arterectomy. You know, you talked about the dye test, and that is an important test to take a look at the vascular tree. And they can also do a magnetic resonance angiogram, which can give them a detailed idea, and that may or may not use a dye. So they can do the CT version or the MR version. So that's one thing. And then for the treatment, basically, if you have such significant blockage and there's small flow, then the risk for a stroke is very high. So with the carotid end arterectomy, what they do is either neurosurgeons or vascular surgeons will do this. They'll go inside the blood vessel and remove the plaque. And then the other thing that they can do is angioplasty, stenting, carotid artery stenting. And in this, what they do is basically they go in with a balloon and inflate that area, and then they put a little bucket that can catch any of the plaques that are, you know, any small parts of the plaque that break off.
Yeah. And I don't like that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then the end arterectomy has been around a very, very long time. It's true and tried, and for the longest time was the only thing. And, you know, its success rate is very high. So if you've never had a stroke or a TIA before, its success rate is 70% or higher. So I wouldn't hesitate, because a stroke is a bad prognosis. And then they may leave you on blood thinners, too, for a long time.
Well, I'm taking right now. I'm taking a aspirin,
mm-hmm.
and I'm taking That's about it so far as this.
After surgery, they may leave you on a thinner for a blood thinner for a while, and then they might take it away, depending upon, you know, what they find. But the endarterectomy is a true and tried treatment surgically. It's been around for a very long time, okay?
Yes, okay. So you say that's the best you can tell me on that, right?
Yeah. But I do think you should go ahead and get it done, because if you have that significant a blockage, the last thing you want is a stroke.
Okay, what about this T-carb thing where they go into your groin?
Yeah, again, in good hands, you know, if that's what you want to do, by all means, go for it. Less risk for side effects. So I think you'll have to understand from them a little bit more. But the first one that has been around is the endarterectomy, and then the other ones are more newer. But in good hands with minimal side effects, you can get good results.
Yeah.
Okay,
Charles.
Just one more quick thing.
Yeah.
If I've got other things going on with me, like if I've got, you know, like other problems, like on my back, shoulder, you know, and arthritis and other things, will this affect, you know, the way the outcome of it would be?
Of the arthritis? Mainly affects your neurocognitive functioning and the risk for stroke. It will lower the risk for stroke. I mean, when you have a stenosis, the symptoms usually are dizziness, lightheadedness, visual problems. You can faint or pass out. You can have headaches. And sometimes if you have a TIA, you may have a temporary weakness, TIA being transient ischemic attack, and that'll get better. But right?
Okay. Yeah.
But the back and the degenerative joint disease, that's not related to this, unless, you know, you have other medical issues.
Well,
degenerative joint.
I was just actually saying, you know, the other things I had going on, because when they do you in there for pre-testing, they'll ask you, you know.
They do. You have to clear. You do. Absolutely. You let them know that. You have to clear surgery. Because remember, when they're going to put you under anesthesia, they want to make sure that your heart is healthy enough, and they have to make sure the medications that you're taking have to be accounted for, your blood pressure is fine, and those kinds of things. So that you have to clear the pre-surgery anesthesia protocol before they will operate.
Okay, so when they're putting the dye in, they don't put you under, do they?
On what? No, they don't put you under for the dye, no.
Okay, all right.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, well, I think that's about as just I get right now, but like I say, you know, I just wanted to call and find out from the masters, you know, how this thing, you know, should work, you know.
There you go. And we're wishing you the best on this, Charles.
Yeah, all the best, and happy to help, and wish you a good outcome.
Yes.
Okay.
When will the main man be back?
I think he's going to be back in 1 or 2 weeks.
Yes.
Oh, that long? Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks for the information. I'll try to put it together, use it as best as I can.
All right.
Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you, Charles. Let's take a quick break here, and then we're back with Susie from Stanwood. Stay right there, and we'll have time for you if you have a question. One or two more callers at 206-421-5757. Leading Edge Medicine. We'll be right back. Stay there.
And I said, hey, pretty lady, won't you give me a sign? I'd give anything to make you my own mind. I'll be your written and be call. Yeah, I've never seen anyone looking so fine. Man, I gotta have her, she's a one of a kind. I'm going once, going twice, I'm sold. The lady in the second row, she's an 8, she's a 9, she's a 10, I know. She's got creepy red lips, blonde hair, blue eyes, and I'm about to bid my heart goodbye.
And we're back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. Hi there. Good morning. My name is Lynette, here with Dr. Samira Umat, taking your calls at 206-421-5757. Time for one more call, maybe one or two more calls. Right now, headed to Stanwood. Susie, thank you so much for your patience. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Susie.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was calling regarding my last blood test.
Okay.
My platelet count was 140, and normally it's always been around 250 over all the past years, and so I was wondering if I should be concerned about it dropping practically 100 points?
Very good question. And so just for the benefit of the listeners, you find out about platelets. We had another question on another show earlier today about the complete blood count and the platelets being measured in that. And so normally the range goes up to 450,000. And if you are usually about 250, that's normal. Sometimes I do see people drop a little bit below 150, around 140. I usually don't worry about that. If it's a sudden drop and there's no cause, you know, it could be a lab outlier. If you're otherwise feeling healthy, I'd just wait till the next one to see where it's going. But I would maybe just, you know, be careful about what medications you're taking, especially if you've taken any over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications or you've been started on a new drug. They are a very common culprit of causing some problem like this. So be careful about that. Maybe back off on anything like that. And then just wait out till the next blood draw to see what's going on.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your answers.
Yeah, you're very welcome. You know, we do commonly see that platelet count decreases when patients have some autoimmune conditions. We worry about infections. Were you sick at all? Did you have an infection? Did anything happen?
No, I wasn't sick.
Okay.
And I haven't had anything unusual. Or, you know, any big changes or anything. So.
No new medications, no blood pressure meds or antibiotics or statins or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, Aleve, Advil.
Yeah, I was taking Allegra every day.
Okay.
For probably 5 months.
Okay.
They did put me on an acid reflux pill also that I took for probably 5 months during this time.
Okay.
Those were both new, and that was for my asthma. They were trying to help for my asthma. But other than that, I wasn't taking anything, you know, new.
Anything new or out of the ordinary for you. All right. Well, what I would say is, you know, try to avoid aspirin, Advil, Aleve, things like that. If you start noticing any bleeding from your gums, then I'd say, okay, go in and get another test done quickly. But otherwise, things that you could do to help those platelet counts are eating foods rich in iron. So, you know, as much as I'm careful about red meat, if you're low in iron, you may need a little replenishment of iron.
I see. Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'll try that. Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you
but
again.
As a general rule, I do see these numbers fluctuate up and down. We measure them often enough in our clinics. And then sometimes if it's just something that's not quite in line with what's happened in the past, it could also be an outlier. And so I just never panic with one reading, especially if it's around 140. I'm not that worried about it. But certainly just be careful. Keep your mind alert. Avoid things that may cause it to drop even further. And especially if you've had an infection, you know that, okay, these could have caused it to go down. And then just pay attention to, you know, diet a little bit, iron-rich foods, and then hopefully by the next blood draw, it'll be back up to where it should be.
Okay, that sounds good.
Right?
Okay.
Okay, otherwise I haven't heard you say anything else that gives me cause for concern or that's something that, you know, I feel you should be worried about at this time.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Susie.
All the best.
Okay, looks like time for another call. Bob calling in from Bothell. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Bob.
Hey, if I was wonderful, I wouldn't be calling you.
Oh, dear. We always get those, right?
That's
right. Wait till it's broken.
Yeah. That's right. How can we help?
I help you, Bob?
I got an issue with testosterone.
Oh, okay.
I had
finally
I
a
had
question some, that I'd work with.
There you go. Yes.
All right.
I had some issues, and I had a blood test, and the blood test showed I had a level of 170.
Okay.
And it said on the blood test, it said it was low.
Okay.
And it said the low range is 240.
Okay.
And the high range was like 916.
Okay.
And I talked to the doctor's assistant, And he says, well, we're not concerned about that. I said, well, hey, listen, I occupy this body 24/7, and I'm the owner, and I have a concern, a major concern.
Yeah.
And so then they gave me some options of a cream or an injection.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm just leery. So what do you guys use? What's your recommendation?
Well, it's so sad that you're calling at this hour when we're ready to go off the air.
I
wish
use the
you
cream.
Had called you
behind my
called
knees.
Me earlier. So, Bob, testosterone is a very important hormone, not just for one function, but it is a neurohormone that performs multiple functions in your body.
Mm-hmm.
It is important for your brain, for your cognition, for your self-confidence, for your muscle, for your bones, for feeling good, for improving your cardiovascular health. And so when you're down to below normal, mm-hmm. then replacing it makes sense because it's not just sexuality it helps with. It helps with everything else. I said, you have testosterone receptors everywhere in your body, and this hormone makes an impact on how you feel, how you do, how you function. I mean, men get osteopenia and osteoporosis and break bones too from lack of testosterone. So yes, replacing sure. it is important. How you replace it is also important, and everybody has their own opinion on that. You can use creams, you can use injections, you can also use pellets, which are basically put under the skin, and then you don't need to do anything, and you go and replace them every 3 months. When we first started doing this, they were using injections alone, and they would give injections once a month, and they found that these injections caused a huge peak followed by a trough. So people would go from feeling over-treated and having the side effects sometimes, then to dropping too low before the next injection. Then they started injecting more frequently, and sometimes some people will inject once a week or twice a week now. What I found in my practice is that men will use it for convenience, but it becomes old after a while because you're not following physiology. Normal human physiology is that you peak the hormone first thing in the morning. There's a second slight peak around dinner time for testosterone in men, and then it falls off during the rest of the day. And so if you follow the transdermal route, which is with creams, it is follows more of the physiological pathway with a boost right in the morning. We cannot copy the second boost in the evening, but then during the course of the day, the cream dwindles and decreases, and then you reapply it in the morning, which is normal physiology. So what you choose depends upon your lifestyle and which convenience factor you need. Some people tell me, I can't be bothered with applying a cream and rubbing it off every day. Give me something that's convenient, and then they use the injections. But in my practice, over the course of time, I have found most of my men will get away from the injections because they get tired of injecting themselves, and then they come into the creams. But the creams, we have to kind of look at the dosing. We have to think about where we apply it and also be very careful about what the base we use. But compounding pharmacies make these, and we can adjust your dose and give you the right dose for you without causing a huge peak and then a trough, which happens with the injections. So at the end of the day, it'll depend upon you, which form you use. In our clinics, we preferentially use the transdermal creams just because we can adjust them easily. If you're too high, we can lower the dose and adjust it lower. If you're having a day where you want to be hang out with the grandkids, we'll educate you about not using the cream on the day when you're around grandkids. So there's a lot that we can do to make it good for you and give you the right dose. With the creams, it allows me more flexibility. With the injections, a little bit harder to do. Pellets, some people love it and some people hate it. We do not do pellets at this time in our clinic. We might in the future. Okay? Does that help?
Double wow. That will take care of my 12 to 15 hours a day in bed.
12 to 15 hours in bed? What do you mean?
It's I go to bed at like midnight, 1 o'clock, and I'm just getting up now. That's
okay.
Why I didn't call earlier.
Ah, okay.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, that's
okay.
11 or 12 hours.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you can then apply the cream when you wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All
okay.
right.
Okay.
And so
but definitely
for the cream.
Yes, you would. Are you a patient, or are you thinking about it?
No.
You are thinking about it.
I used to be a patient. Then I got into a financial dilemma. But anyway, and I did the cream when I was a patient.
Okay. Yeah,
right.
You would need to be a patient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In order for us to prescribe, you would have to. So come on back. Either you can do a restart or you can do a health analysis visit, and then we'll get your numbers and we'll get you started.
Okay.
Okay. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you very
much. All right,
much.
Bob. Thank you so much for the call. All right. Lots of variety again today on the show, Leading Edge Medicine. And we are glad that you're here. We would love you to be a patient at Longevity as well. And right now we have three clinics, Linwood, Tacoma, and our newly beautiful, remodeled and opened Kirkland facility. So what you need to do is get on the phone and make an appointment to get that free health analysis appointment. 866-86-YOUNG. Young is the number to call. That's 866-86-YOUNG. Or you can go online to lmclinic.com. That's lmclinic.com. Right there, you can click on free health analysis appointment, pick the day, the time, and the clinic that works best for you. And we'll get you scheduled, get you in, seeing our doctors, and get you on the way to being stronger, leaner, faster, smarter, sexier, and happier. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week live in the studio, and we hope to see you then. Enjoy your day. Stay dry. And if you've got some sunshine where you are, go outside and take a walk. We'll be back next week. This is Leading Edge Medicine. Have a great week.